It is a wonderful event. We had our alumni gala last year as well in Chicago, but this year it's going to be at the Art Institute, which is a beautiful venue. So that's Saturday, April 27th in Chicago. With that, I'd like to introduce our moderator, Dr. Phil Powell. Dr. Powell is Associate Dean of Academic Programs at Kelly Indianapolis and the Clinical Associate Professor of Business Economics and Public Policy, and he's going to share a few remarks about the Kelly School and introduce the rest of the panel. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. How are we doing this morning? Ready to predict the future? We are. We have a lot of magic balls down in Bloomington and up here at IUPUI. Anyway, Dean Kessner sends her greetings. She couldn't be here. She's in Evansville this morning. But it's great to see so many members of the Kelly family, so many friendly faces and friends of the programs that we have on both campuses. As you know, at the heart of what we do at the Kelly School of Business from both Bloomington and IUPUI, if you were to crystallize our mission is to build human capital for prosperity in Indiana and beyond. And we do that by disseminating knowledge and graduating talent that makes companies globally competitive. And at the end of the day, our companies here in Indianapolis, in this great state of Indiana, are globally competitive if they're making better business decisions. So we as faculty and staff and deans, and we want our graduates to go out there and make, on a daily basis, make better decisions. And in order to make better decisions, you have to have a sense of the variables that you cannot control, the economy and politics. It's wonderful to talk about. That's where we come together each November with our business outlook panels all around the state. But also, we want to make sure that we deliver this to you in a way that you can take back to your businesses and your organizations and make smart decisions as you plan for the year ahead. Because if you're prosperous, our communities are prosperous, and you're helping to deliver on the Kelly mission. I want to thank our panel this morning, who are going to give some great insights on what perhaps where we're headed this next year, the U.S. economy, and on down to the local. But let me very quickly make some introductions here, and then I'm going to hand it over. We're going to start with Professor Bill Witte. Where's Bill? Bill's here at the end. Bill retired 10 years ago from the Bloomington campus in the Department of Economics, but he's been a part of the Business Outlook panels for a long time. Bill's going to give us some insights on the national economy. And then we'll move to Professor Chuck Trzinka, who's the James and Virginia Kozad Professor of Finance in our finance department in Bloomington. Chuck's going to talk to something near and dear to our hearts, near and dear to our retirement portfolios, and that's the financial markets. We'll then move to the state level with Tim Slaper. Tim is Director of Economic Analysis at our Indiana Business Research Center. And then we'll bring it home. We'll bring it home here with Professor Kyle Anderson, who's our chair of our evening MBA program here at IUPUI. And Kyle's also a professor of business economics. So let's get out our magic balls here. Bill, can you get it started for us?
Thanks, Phil. Good morning, everybody. Hope you didn't get too wet getting here. I want to do two things this morning. The first one is to review the economic situation over the last year and to look at our outlook for next year. And the second is to discuss briefly some of the things that could upset our outlook. And I'm afraid most of the things I'll talk about there are for the worse. So starting with the economic situation and outlook. When economists look at the economy, the primary measure that they use to gauge how we're doing is the level of output, or what we call real gross domestic product. Over the past four quarters, and that's through the third quarter of this year where we got preliminary data a week or so ago, growth has come in just over 3%. A year ago, I forecast that growth would be about 2.5%. But I threw in a proviso that if meaningful tax reform were passed, that would add about 0.5% to growth. Tax reform was passed. 2.5 plus 1.5 is 3, so we did pretty well there. Now, what about this year? Well, we think 2019 could be another pretty good year, with growth again coming in about 3%, although we think that growth will decelerate as the year goes along. So it'll be a little bit better than 3% maybe at the first half of this 2019, and then shrinking as we go along. Okay, so that's output. The second thing that economists look at when they're trying to gauge the macroeconomic situation is the labor market. Looking at the labor market, concentrate on increases in employment and what's happening to unemployment. A year ago, we thought that employment would increase about 170,000 a month, which would not have been a bad performance. But in fact, that was too cautious. Through September, we get October's numbers tomorrow morning at 8:30. The average increase, so for the first 9 months of the year, has been 208,000 per month. That's pretty significantly above 170. So we were a little bit pessimistic there. We thought that unemployment would decline a little. It was 4.1% at this time last year, and we thought that it might tick below 4%. The September number was 3.7%, so that's a little lower than what we thought. Again, we were a little bit too cautious. In 2019, we expect sort of a replay of this year. We expect employment growth to continue at close to 200,000 a month. It would be a little bit less than what we've seen so far this year, but not a whole lot. Now, that's predicated on a guess that the labor force participation rate, the proportion of the population that's actually participating in the labor market, will remain roughly stable, which it has done for the last several years, but which, from a long-run perspective, is not a good forecast. Over the long run, the participation rate in the United States is going to drop because of the underlying demographics associated with the retirement of the baby boom. Over the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen it hold stable in the face of that downward drag, that gravity from demographics. And we think that that can continue for the next year. If it doesn't, achieving the job growth that I'm talking about, close to 200, will be hard to achieve. On the unemployment side, we think that unemployment from the 3.7 where we are now can tick down on another couple of ticks. 3.5 maybe is achievable. 3.5, anything below 3.7 would be the lowest since the 1960s. In the 1960s, it got down to 3.4. That's the lowest since the 1950s. During the Korean War, we got down in the twos. We're not going to get down in the twos. We probably won't get down to 3.4 this time, but we think we can get pretty close to that. If that's the labor market we have, growth in jobs something up close to 200,000 and an unemployment rate down towards 3.5, labor shortages are going to be a continuing story in the economy, as they have been this year. And then the third thing that economists think about at the macro level is the inflation rate. A year ago, we thought that inflation would rise from about 1.5% during 2017 to something a little bit over 2%. That's pretty much exactly what's happened. Next year, we expect that inflation will move up another notch, so to something like 2.5%. I think there is some risk, particularly if the dollar starts to weaken in the foreign exchange market, that we could see more significant problems with inflation than that. Although I should say that there's absolutely zero sign to date that the dollar is going to decline in value. It has been rising. So to summarize, the past year the economy was better than okay. 3% growth, 3.7% unemployment, that's pretty good. Maybe about as good as it gets. And factoring in the tax cut, our forecast last year was pretty good. To summarize our outlook for next year, we see 2019 as a sequel of 2018. Solid growth, continuing strong labor market. Okay, in my experience, sequels almost never measure up to the original, right? Think about Independence Day. Now, there are exceptions, though. Think about Guardians of the Galaxy. You can tell I like science fiction stuff. And for a number of reasons, I'm worried that not measuring up is going to be the case this year. So to begin with, there's the fiscal policy situation. Fiscal policy right now is a source of both certainty and uncertainty. The certain side is that the budget deal, which was reached at the beginning of this year, runs out at the end of the 2019 fiscal year, which is this time next year. So that's the certainty. And the fact that it runs out is one of the reasons why we see some deceleration later next year. On the uncertain side, I don't have a clue. I don't think anybody has a clue what is going to happen to replace the budget deal. The forecast sort of assumes that they sort of extend it without increasing it at all, which means that the growth that we've had over the last year in fiscal policy and will have into next year will slow down. If you just maintain a level of spending, you're not growing. But we don't know. And whatever that decision is, it could very well be made with a Congress that's partly or wholly under Democratic control, which will make decision-making, I think, a lot more problematic. So that's a big uncertainty, and my guess would be with some downside potential. Second, monetary policy. The Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. It's raised interest rates from close to zero to something a little bit over 2% to date. In our forecast, I'm assuming that they raise rates again in December and then two times next year and then stop. Now, that's more cautious than what I had a couple of months ago where I thought they would do three increases in 2019. And that's sort of the path that the Fed itself has laid out. But I don't think they'll go that far. That would put the rate at just under 3%, the federal funds rate, next year, at the end of next year. Housing is sensitive to interest rates, and housing has been pretty weak, and higher interest rates probably don't say good things about are a headwind for housing. In the forecast, I have housing doing better next year. If it doesn't do better, that'll take a couple of tenths off the growth rate. And of course, over the last month, we've seen that the stock market doesn't like higher interest rates, for sure. Okay, third potential problem is the trade war with China. A couple of months ago, I would have said the potential trade war with China, but I think we have one. Talk about shooting yourself in the head. Usually that doesn't turn out too well. But how it turns out is anybody's guess. And then finally, the forecast rests on solid growth in business investment. Okay? And until the third quarter, business investment had been doing very well. Over the last four quarters that preceded the third quarter, business investment was strong. Double-digit growth in a couple of quarters. But the third quarter, it was lousy. Investment in structures was negative, investment in equipment was flat. That pattern, several good quarters followed by a bust. Now, one quarter doesn't make a trend, okay, say that. But followed by a bust is very similar to what happened in 2013 and 2014, where we got an investment boom that was driven by the fracking boom, followed by a bust when oil prices dropped and fracking dropped off. It looks a lot like that now. And if that's the pattern we are in, meaning that business investment is not strong over the next year, it means that my forecast will be significantly too optimistic. And remember, these are decisions made by businessmen. Business doesn't like policy uncertainty. They don't like rising interest rates. They don't like weak equity prices. And they don't like tariffs. So there are a lot of reasons why if business wants to be cautious, they can find reasons to do it. So a whole lot of uncertainties, and all to the downside. But as of now, looking at where the actual data is, the economy is good. The labor market is very good. And our forecast is that we have enough momentum to muddle through 2019. Beyond that, keep your fingers crossed. Now, unlike the larger economy, 2018 hasn't been a really great year in financial markets. So what can we expect there next year? Chuck?
Thanks, Bill. Bill just forecasted the labor market. He forecasted the inflation, international trade. He's got an econometric model with, I don't know, what, 50 equations in it, representing 50 markets. I just have one market to forecast, so it's just the stock market. Every time I do this, I need to remind my wife that my salary doesn't depend on my forecast. Perhaps I should tell you that, too. But on the other hand, from last year, it turns out that I was right, maybe by accident, maybe not. So this year, we've had the characteristic last year had been very little volatility. That was exactly opposite this year. The market experienced one of its worst months in October, where it fell 8%. Yet earnings were up in every sector. Revenues are forecast to grow in 2019. The private sector is one of the factors driving the GDP, and you just heard Bill talk about both the labor market and the and business investment doing well. Yet the market started the year at about $27-28 trillion. We gained about $3 trillion. We lost about $3 trillion up and down this year. We're roughly gaining it this year. So what's been causing this fluctuation? Well, there's the Jim Cramer view that it's trade and the Fed. Certainly, every time there has been a trade problem or a potential trade war, and perhaps now a war, we've seen the stock market fall. The most recent was last Monday. Bloomberg announced that we may have more tariffs on the rest of the trade from China, $275 billion, Dow fell 100. Yet revenues are 62% of revenues for S&P companies come from U.S. The tariffs themselves are not that high a percentage of GDP. So the question of whether trade is important it depends on where you think how flexible the supply chain is. Of course, the trade news is not good. Trade wars are never good, and particularly when people in the White House believe that a trade deficit is somebody taking advantage of you. Yet you have to keep this in perspective. The second thing that's been hurting the stock market, is the interest rates. Interest rates have clearly responded to strong economic growth and the federal deficit. I mean, we've got a growing deficit. We're approaching $800 billion, I think that's in Bill's forecast. There are a lot of people who think, I think his forecast goes, we're going to be at a trillion. That has an increased effect on interest rates. The U.S. Treasury 10-year rate is up above 3%. 3.1, 3.14. The corporate bonds are 7-8%. And clearly the money supply is growing at a slower rate. Okay, and that's what the Fed funds rate is. The Fed increased the federal funds rate three times this year. Bill has them going one more and maybe a couple times next year. The growth in the money supply has been less this year than it has been per year in the past 17. But still, earnings are good. I mean, 77% of firms in the S&P 500 are beating expectations. Earnings growth for third quarter was 22%. Third quarter sales have been strong. The best sectors are information technology and communication. The guidance at this point is fourth quarters are mixed, but still up. For 2019, earnings are expected to rise 10% for the S&P 500. The revenue is supposed to be about 5 to 6%. So clearly there's going to be some cost cutting. Also, the valuation ratios are down, which from my perspective is good because there's room to move up. At this time last year, I was talking about how the Shiller ratio had reached its close to 30-year high, how the forward ratio that is earnings forecasted earnings divided by the current stock market was at a high. It's no longer at a high. The S&P 500 has a PE ratio of about 21. The forward rates are about 16, so there's room to move up there. The markets, the dividend rates are about the same in spite of GE's cut of dividends. The analysts are forecasting about $800 billion in stock repurchases. So last year I was talking about something called the VIX, which is called the fear index. It's based on options on the S&P 500, and it being very, very flat. Well, it's no longer flat. The VIX is up and down, clearly responding to both macroeconomic decisions and policy decisions coming out of the White House. So to reiterate, Bill forecasted 2.5% inflation, little over 3% GDP growth, a labor market that's growing, and possibly a problem with the budget deal. We still see, on interest rates, though, credit spreads being fairly low. I mean, the difference between the BAA and the U.S. Treasury of the same maturity is about 200 basis points. That's roughly what it's been for the past. It's up a little bit, but that's what it's been for the past past 4 or 5 years. So how does this add up? Well, I mean, last year I forecasted below average return, and we're there. Maybe today we might get to a little bit higher, but it still looks below average. I think that's still a good forecast. In fact, I think today that the chance of a negative return is growing. I think that with the choking of supply chains, we could find negative returns, even though earnings are strong. There's no question about that. And I think that interest rates will probably, Bill's got them forecasted to go up slightly. I'm certain the markets show that. The mortgage rate is now 4.875 for a 30-year mortgage. So I think that's reflecting also increased inflation rate. So the outlook for the financial markets are, I'm still positive. I mean, I haven't allocated anything out of equities yet, but I'm more cautious than at least as cautious as I was last year, and perhaps more cautious than I was. Thank you.
Hi, if you don't mind me saying, you guys used to talk a whole lot longer, Bill and Chuck, when the news was bad. I guess the news is better now, and there's less to talk about. Seriously, in as long as I can remember, we've always prefaced our forecasts with guardedly optimistic, or cautiously optimistic, or underwhelmingly optimistic. Can we just be optimistic for once? Yeah, we're actually doing fairly well compared to the presentations we have made in the past. So maybe this is going to be a short breakfast. I don't know. In terms of the state outlook, we're doing pretty well. In terms of our neighboring states, Our unemployment rate is the lowest of the bunch. They may beat us in football, but we're beating them in terms of unemployment rates. So what really counts there, all right? So in terms of manufacturing states, 10 manufacturing states that are similar to Indiana, which like includes North Carolina, Wisconsin, and all, only Iowa and Wisconsin have lower unemployment rates. So we're doing well compared to our neighboring states, as well as a basket of states that are heavily manufacturing oriented. Now, Bill Witte estimates that about gross state product growth of about 5% in nominal dollars, that's about 3% in real dollars. But, you know, they've also did mention the whole notion of potential tariffs, trade war possibilities. And the U.S. Chamber has estimated that about a trade war would shave about $2 billion of gross state product off of our balance sheet. So, or our income statement, I should say, which is about 0.5% of gross state product. So that's not insignificant if we go into an all-out trade war. In terms of Mexico and Canada, that total would be about $800 million. Almost half of that value would be retaliatory intervention, shall we say, with Mexico and Canada. So there was some mention of investment, and that a lot of the investment fluctuations we've seen in the market are a result of oil and gas. And so we're not really making a lot of money, employing a lot of people in that particular sector. When it comes to kind of more broadly based investment, it's not clear that Indiana is doing particularly well in terms of investing in the state. When you look at venture capital rates are higher in our five neighboring states. So that isn't a good indicator of, you know, inflows of investment into the state. We do still pretty well in terms of foreign direct investment and the jobs associated with that, but in terms of venture capital, not so much. We forecast that the growth in jobs is going to be lower than our output growth. So if we're thinking in terms of about 3% or a little bit less than that, the growth in jobs is going to be lower than our output. So our output has been growing more quickly, if you will, than our the amount of number of people that are employed. And this could be attributed to, say, automation. It could be attributed to other factors, potentially offshoring. As it happens, I have a paper that's coming out in about a month on offshoring versus automation. You're going to have to read it because I'm not going to tell you everything that's in it. But the question that is posed in the whole notion of automation, for example, is, you know, have we really replaced jobs in Indiana with automation? And it's difficult to get data at that granular level. If you look at automation robotics investment, it didn't start really coming into play until about 2014. So in terms of displacing jobs with automation, it becomes a little difficult to make that case. Now, our center does a lot of work in terms of regional economic development, state economic development, and if somebody said, "Are you for or against automation?" I would go, "Well, I'm not sure I know." If you go, kind of poll the nation in terms of local development practitioners, there are some that are running away from it. They look at all the industry list of industries prone to automation, and they say, "We don't want to try to attract that kind of foreign direct investment because they'll set up a plant and then, you know, turn it into robots and all the people will be, you know, unemployed." Others are saying, "Let's embrace automation. Let's attract the companies that are most highly automated." The rationale there being that the jobs are not going to go away. You have a lot of investment. It's pretty, you know, stationary. There's a lot of money to be invested in robotics. So those jobs aren't going to go away. It would add to vibrancy. And the great thing about robotics is that we retiring people would have someone to take care of us as we get older, right? So yeah, as they move away from assembling cars to, say, healthcare. So moving on to some of the risks and there are many that both Chuck and Bill mentioned. One of the risks that I think is, at least has stabilized, is related to the opioid crisis. I mean, it costs a lot of money. It has destroyed a lot of lives. It reduces labor force participation. You know, we've hit a level of participation that may not be, you know, that we can't get out of. In other words, there's nobody that can enter the workforce because of, say, opioid addictions. So it lowers productivity. It lowers options that way. As we know, Indiana is an auto state, and we're expecting about 17 million units sold this coming year, and that's a very robust number. So that looks good. And if you consider the fact that now, thanks to hurricanes, we have a whole bunch of cars that were underwater or destroyed, we got to replace them. So we're going to be able to replace them with hopefully some parts and vehicles that are manufactured and assembled here. Not that we necessarily want to inflict hurricanes on people in order for our own economic benefits, but that seems to be what some people are predicting. Then the question is, what do we do with all these cars that are now useless because they were underwater, whether it was with Harvey, now with Michael and Florence? And I would argue that we can just stack them up to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. And any of the cars that are still drivable, we can sell them to those people in the caravan for the trip back. There you go. All right. So what else is going on in terms of the auto sector? It's difficult to predict what will happen in terms of the new trade agreement. Some people call it NAFTA 2.0. It's called the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, which doesn't really sound particularly good. I like the term, instead of NAFTA, NAGDA, North American Great Trade Agreement, okay? North America Great Trade Agreement. In terms, they've already mentioned some of the risks associated with a looming recession. Right now, we don't see that. If you look at this little matrix that they talk about in terms of 1 year out, 2 years out, 3 years out, we're at about 25% chance of a recession within the next year. This is just general U.S. economy. And it ups to about 75% in 4 years. And a lot of that has to do with the yield curve, whether or not there's that classic inversion. It may be time for us to resurrect the leading indicators for Indiana. Nobody seems to care about that when things are going well, but if we're on the turn, that might be an interesting thing to resurrect then. But overall, it looks like we are going to return to the mean, which we hope is around 3% growth, and I think we can remove those terms cautiously, guardedly, etc. Fill in the qualifier of your choice, the just plain optimistic. Thank you.
So, good morning. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Indianapolis economy. Sorry if I'm moving a little slow this morning, a little Halloween hangover, if you will. I took my daughter out trick-or-treating last night because I'm an economist, and whenever they give out free stuff, right, I'm on board. It's a little awkward because she's 17. She didn't really want to go, but, you know, that's the way it goes. As it happened, I went around the neighborhood. You know, when people give out candy, they're dressed up as scary things often. And I happened to go by Bill's house. It was very scary. He was dressed as Fed Chair Jay Powell, screaming about quantitative tightening and interest rates increasing. It was horrifying. Happened to go by Chuck's house. Chuck was just dressed up as a giant asset bubble. Tim was just dressed as trillion-dollar tariffs. It was quite a creative costume. So October was a scary month for markets and for a lot of the economy. So I think we're all glad to have it over and be ready for November. Indianapolis, our local economy, is really doing quite well. Tim You know, as you've heard, the national economy has been strong. Tim remarked how Indiana's doing well. Well, I would argue that Indianapolis gets a lot of the best part of Indiana in terms of economic growth. And that's just, I think, a lot of growth right now is occurring within cities and metropolitan areas as opposed to rural parts of the state. We'll go around to different parts of the state, and it's refreshing to go out to some other communities and hear about their challenges and then come back and realize Indianapolis really has a lot going for it and doesn't have the same level of challenges as a lot of the communities in other parts of the state. Our fundamental economy is quite strong. We added 22,000 jobs last year, which is about an increase of 2.1%. The unemployment rate in the area is about 3.5%. So, I mean, you really are not going to go much lower than that. It's a job seeker's market right now, and that's generally a good thing for most of us, unless, of course, we're trying to hire. That creates some significant challenges. In terms of job sectors, it's a little bit, the data show what you might suspect that they would show. Transportation, warehousing, services, jobs are up 12% over the last year, right? Indiana continues to be a hub for the distribution of goods within the state and within the country, so it's not surprising to see that data. Retail jobs were down 6.5%. Again, all of our behavior, that we're not surprised to see that. We're buying stuff on Amazon. We're consuming electronic services instead of buying goods from local retailers, and the jobs are bearing that out. Other areas, the healthcare and social services are up 4.5%. Aging population. Indianapolis has a little bit stronger, a little bit overweight in the healthcare sector. About 15% of jobs are in healthcare in the Indianapolis economy. So it's not surprising to see growth in those areas and other markets not doing as well. A year ago, we were seeing significant weakness in the housing and construction markets. The number of permits were lower in 2017 than they had been. Housing prices were kind of flat. That's actually reversed course over the last year. So we're seeing a significant upturn in the construction, especially in residential construction. Housing prices are up significantly over the last year. So you've got this kind of trade-off situation going on where we've got a good economy, people are wanting to make investments, but we're also seeing increased mortgage rates. And I think there's going to come a time when mortgage rates get high enough that it significantly dampens the enthusiasm for people moving for some new residential construction. We haven't seemed to hit it yet, but I expect that we'll get there relatively soon. Overall, we've got a lot of good things going on. Just in the last month, in terms of downtown, we've seen big announcements on the waterside project that probably won't really impact our 2019 outlook, but over the long term, some big projects that portray an optimism about the local economy. Just in the last week or two, we've had announcements about the potential for an expanded convention center, new hotels just a couple blocks down. Again, these are not projects that will affect the short term, but over the longer term, assuming they all go through, and I think they're very early stages, will have a significant positive impact on the downtown economy. We're also seeing some good things in terms of technology jobs, whether it's the continued presence of companies like Salesforce, the Infosys growth, a tech startup community that is really relatively small for the size of the economy, but plays an important outsized role, and it seems to be doing extremely well. So the city is benefiting from the technology jobs. We're also seeing a lot of public investment in terms of infrastructure. whether you look at what Carmel has done over the last number of years. There was an announcement recently that Plainfield wants to make significant investments in making their town more of a town and less of a just kind of a suburban area. Speedway has had a lot of development in that area, and I think we're going to continue to see this kind of infrastructure investment really trying to draw the communities and towns around the area as building on quality of life, good places to live, and not just places to have your house and commute from. So our forecast for 2019 is continued strong growth. I have that similar optimism that Tim does about the local outlook. Wages are going to continue to rise, and our general forecast, now that Halloween is over, is significantly less spooky. So, thank you.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm glad I don't live in your neighborhood. Anyway, we want to get you out of here on time, folks, at 9 o'clock. But we've got about 15 minutes for questions. We've got a couple microphones around. Usually, it's easy to get the second question than the first question. Any entrepreneurs out there? Anybody with a question? Otherwise, I can get it rolling here. Gentlemen, when you look at the economy, there are two, and businesses talk about this, there's two more fundamental issues that we haven't talked about too much that question the sustainability of the current economic structure, and that's one is our debt and our deficit. Chuck and Bill, you did touch on that, and also the institutional impact of rising income inequality. If you look at our measures of income inequality nationally, they match, they're as high as they were back in the 1910s, which is probably the last peak that we saw. So in terms of where the 2019 looks good, but as we go maybe a couple years out, do these issues worry you, or perhaps they don't? And how does that link to the long-term sustainability of things?
Why don't you go first? And I'll...
Well, is this on? Yeah, I guess it is. To be perfectly honest, all of the talk about inequality doesn't really worry me very much. I think that the thing that the history of macroeconomics shows is that what matters is the rate of economic growth, and that if the economy grows, it helps the people at the bottom. And frankly, in this country, I think the people at the bottom just want to do better. You know, they want to be able to improve their standard of living. And if that comes along with the people at the top doing better, maybe even better than they're doing, that's not so much of a concern. It's a concern to some in the political class, okay? But I don't think it's a real concern. And economically, if you look at the data, as I read it, when the economy grows more rapidly, inequality tends to decrease. It increases when the economy grows slowly. And it increases because when the economy grows slowly, the people that come out with the short end of the stick are the ones at the bottom. Okay? If you look at the last 10 years, we're 10 years out now from the Great Depression. Over that 10 years, the people at the top have done, even though the economy wasn't growing rapidly, it was growing at a 2% rate, which is low for this country. The people at the top, which is probably most all of us, did just fine. You know, my portfolio, I retired 10 years ago, so I retired just as the market was cratering. And my portfolio took a hit. But I was in a position where I didn't have to spend that money. I could just leave it sit. And now my portfolio is just fine. You know, but for a lot of people, the last 10 years have been very rough. Okay? People at the top did just fine. I think that right now we're starting to see a little bit of improvement at the bottom. And if we can keep this recovery going, although I laid out a whole bunch of reasons why I'm worried about that. I think the people at the bottom will continue to do better than they did over the last 10 years. So inequality is not at the top of my list of things to worry about.
I certainly agree with that, except that inequality also can fuel political uncertainty, and frankly, that can hurt everything. So increasing taxes, more regulation, that certainly will hurt. But having said that, I also raise the issue of deficit, and I think that's part of the reason we're seeing interest rates going up. So the deficit does matter, and it's beginning to matter more, although not for inflation. I mean, Bill forecasted, in, like everybody else, about 2.5% on inflation, and that will, we can handle that. Interest rates are rising, and how much they rise is another, is anybody's guess. But that, to me, is the biggest immediate risk for 2019 for the deficit. And then the income inequality, I think, certainly I agree that growth drives, helps people at all levels, and people who have been sort of working poor are really very much helped by this growth rate. But having said that, the perception is that they're not doing well, and that drives a political environment that perhaps will tend to pull back. So that's one of the risks. Certainly that's part of the reason why the White House has this trade war going on. But when the Democrats, if they take over Congress, that's also going to be an issue too.
Can I just add in here? Because I guess I would have a little bit. I guess I'm more fundamentally concerned about income inequality as an issue. But I also I do think that, to echo Chuck's point, is the one of the risks is that the reaction will be that the view is that we need to do something about income inequality, and what we do will significantly dampen growth. So what I think I would like to see are policies that there are policies that we can do in terms of whether it's tax rates or how we deal with the deficit that deal with the issue directly but don't exacerbate income inequality, or else I think there could be a political reaction that's harmful to the economy as a whole.
I'm going to chime in just for grins as well. In terms of the deficit, I think that not only has potentially negative economic consequences in the medium run, but it also provides you less wiggle room or fewer options in the future for other policy interventions. And I'm not just talking economic, I'm talking about maybe it's education, maybe it's healthcare, whatever. But you have fewer and fewer options. When your household budget goes into deficit, and you are trying to figure out, you know, do we do X, Y, or Z in terms of, you know, do we, you know, invest in, you know, new windows? Do we go on vacation? Do we buy a new car? You know, if you have plenty of money, you can do all of them. But if you're really tight, you're like, we can only do one of the three. Which one of the three can we do? You know, it limits your options about what you can do as a household, and if you look at the, you know, government and all the rest, the kind of policy interventions that they might want to pursue later on as problems arise. So if you look at moving on to a problem, the inequality issue, something that I think doesn't get quite as much thought is the enormous changes in wealth of the extremely wealthy. You know, we're talking a lot of those folks that are in the technology world, those that create, you know, ones and zeros that make us happy or connect us. And if you consider the fact that in the old days, if you wanted to make a bicycle, you needed, you know, two sets of hands that were attached to a body that was attached to a paycheck. If you want to make 100 bicycles, you have to, you know, increase the number of workers by a factor, say, of 10. If you're trying to make a video game and you're making, you know, 10,000 copies or 100,000 copies, all you got to do is put another zero at the end of the keyboard and tap enter. Suddenly,
the scalability factor of many of the elements that we consume is such that they're not employing people. So you're not getting that kind of robust, as the economy grows, and you know, whether it's video games or whether it's bicycles, if you're making more of it, it shows up in terms of GDP. But you're not seeing the kind of pressure in the labor markets that would eventually transfer into increase in wages, right? Because as demand increases in the labor markets, your wages are also, the cost of that's also going to go up. And we only recently have seen that in the national economy because we've had so much slack in the labor market. And that's actually one of the benefits now of this robust growth is that we see increasing wages kind of across the board.
Excellent. Questions? Did we serve enough coffee? Yes. And we'll have time for this one more.
So to further the conversation about the deficit and debt, I'd be interested in, Kyle, you mentioned some sort of policy approach to this. What would you suggest to our politicians to fix this over the long term that has minimal impact on our long-term growth?
Nothing I suggest would ever get me elected to office. Okay. Of course, you've got to decrease the rate of growth of the social insurance programs that some people call entitlements, Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid. You have to. And now those are the big three. The U.S. government is sort of like an insurance company with a military. Everything else is really a sideshow. If you look at the numbers. And so you've got to do all four. And frankly, the other thing is, if interest rates do hit average levels, the amount of money we're paying it to service the federal debt will be more than what we're giving to the military. So we have to be real careful about this. And the entitlement social insurance reform, I was a fan of the Bowles-Simpson Commission, which had a whole list of things to do, none of which would ever get me elected. In fact, in this environment, no one's even talking about it. But the list is, take Simpson-Bowles. There's the things that will help bring the deficit down to, now they didn't propose to get it to a balanced budget, but it gets to well below 2%, even 1% of GDP. The answer to your question is nothing is, at this point, politically feasible.
I mean, I guess I would agree that probably the reason a lot of these aren't happening is because they're not very politically popular. I mean, I think that we need to decide either we want to have a military that's larger than the next however many countries, or, you know, and if we're going to do that, we need to pay for it. And so I think the tax cuts that we saw last year were a mistake. I think that while it's true they may have led to higher growth in the economy, to run a $1 trillion deficit when we are in the 10th year of an economic expansion and not be able to add what we're adding to the debt every year when our economy has been growing, albeit slowly, but we've not had a recession, is just absolute foolishness. And so, yes, I mean, I think that Chuck's right. It comes down to, our spending comes down to, we either need to increase revenue, higher taxes, look at entitlements, and look at military spending. Because the discretionary bucket, everything else in there, doesn't add up to enough to really move the needle on those things.
If you go to the Concord Coalition, its website, they have a Java applet that lets you cut the deficit a variety of different ways. See how hard it is. I mean, actually go over there and, you know, cut what you want, figure, you know, whatever program you don't like. It's sort of fun to do, but you realize how difficult this is. And so we clearly, and it really starts with the social insurance programs, but the military is also the case, and we really don't have either party. I mean, neither party now is a party of deficit reduction. So, I mean, that's really the answer to your question.
Can I throw a thought grenade into the middle of the room here?
We got 2 minutes.
Okay. It's a pretty short thought. Okay, unfunded pensions, public pensions. All right, who's responsible for that? All right, I mean, that's my evidence of, you know, decisions that were really stupid. I mean, in the federal deficits on a grander scale. I say politicians and their minions that contributed to those unfunded pensions or deficits, we garnish their wages. They get out of office and you're paying it back. You know, you're going to live in a trailer park in Kansas dodging tornadoes if you contribute to the deficit, you know? Hey, you need, instead of, you know, living the high life as a politician after you're out, if you make stupid decisions, you have to pay. The rest of us do.
I'd like to throw in a couple of things. I've been studying macroeconomics since the 1960s. Okay? And I don't think there has ever been a time when there haven't been a significant part of the profession that haven't been raising alarms about the deficit and the debt. And over that entire period, it hasn't mattered. And I'm not convinced that it will ever matter. To begin with, our debt is all denominated in dollars. And that's a big difference from a country like Argentina or someplace like that. Second thing, about the entitlement programs, I'm going to focus on Social Security. I may have said here in the past that the Social Security Act was written by my grandfather. He was the executive director of the Committee on Social Security in the 1930s under the Roosevelt administration. Okay, so I have a vested interest in the Social Security program. Now, the last time I looked, the Social Security system had a significant trust fund surplus. That means that over all of the past history of the Social Security program, it has run a surplus. Its taxes have exceeded the amount that's being paid out. Now, if you extrapolate out in the future with some pessimistic assumptions, that may reverse, okay? If it does, and I think, frankly, that, you know, you can correct that with relatively minor changes. The top of the list would be that Social Security tax should apply to all wage income, not stop at $100,000 or $125,000 where it stops now. Okay? And third, if we do have a problem with the debt at some point in the future, there's only one way it's going to be solved. The political system can't solve it, Chuck and the others said that, and they're right. The way it will be solved is with inflation. We will inflate the debt away. If you have inflation at 4% a year, that debt is going to, in real terms, fall in value by 50% every 18 years. So you'd reduce it, you know, one generation, you reduce it by half. Okay? That's the way it'll be solved. That's the only way it'll be solved. We won't go bankrupt. We'll just, the holders of that debt, the lesson there is that if you got a portfolio, you don't want to have a lot in fixed income stuff. Okay? That's my 30 cents.
Well, there we have it, folks. As we look ahead, so let's give this panel a hand. Thank you. So just to summarize here, folks, 2019, we are optimistic. But we start from a good place. But as you've heard our panel, our communities, our state, our nation does face some fundamental challenges. And remember, as members of the Indiana University community, we wake up each morning to positively touch and transform the people, organizations, and communities that we touch. This is indeed the mission that the Kelley School embraces. And just know that the Kelley School and Indiana University is out there helping to solve these problems. Now, just want to leave with two things. One plug here. Last year, the Kelley School launched a podcast, the ROI Podcast, which is a weekly reflection on great businesses here in the state and also how our state and our communities are addressing some of these issues. In fact, just yesterday we interviewed Danny Lopez, who's chairman of the governor's workforce cabinet, talking about talent, which is a big issue here in the city and the state. So if you're interested in what the Kelley School at Indiana University is doing in terms of driving innovation in business and in economic policy, please listen to that ROI podcast each week. Also, please remember the gala in April in Chicago, wonderful event for the Alumni Association. But anyway, folks, thanks for your gift of time this morning. Hopefully you walk away with some energy and wisdom to go forth and change the world. Anyway, thanks so much. Go Hoosiers. We stand adjourned.
He's good. I'm going to come around.